Aren't you interested in learning breakthrough wealth building strategies, such as how to flip a home in less than 2 weeks using other people's money with no real estate license, or how to build a low-cost home-based business? You can discover how to take passive income from any source and invest it into real estate, stocks, or business to become financially independent investing in any market with Residual Roads Business Institute. Collaborate with Andre and other Residual Roads advisors to create a free action plan and start implementing strategies today. Go to www.residualroads.com or email info@residualroads.com. Welcome to the Investing Uncensored podcast. You've been searching for different ways to become financially independent or generate passive income to live out your life's purpose as you've seen others do it, but need insight on how. Well, get excited because here you'll discover the tips and resources to fulfill that need. Andre Stewart has spent more than a decade successfully making it happen for himself and others. This is the Investing Uncensored podcast. And now here's your host, Andre Stewart.
Welcome to another episode of Investing Uncensored. I'm your host, Andre Stewart. And today we're going to have a guest. His name is Sari Ibrahim. How do you pronounce your last name? That's correct?
Yeah, Sari Ibrahim. Yeah, you said it right.
Sounds good. How's everything, man? I know we spoke a couple weeks ago and you were kind of busy bringing on new clients. You got your own podcast going. How's everything going with you in that aspect?
Yeah, definitely, Andre. Yeah, everything is going good. Blessed, thankful. Yeah, doing well. The only thing is in Chicago, and we're getting ready for a cold winter here in Chicago. Yeah. Everything other than that is going good. The podcast is going good. We just launched episode 34 today.
Okay.
So that's going good. And then, yeah, business is going good. Thankful, blessed for all my clients and everybody I'm working with.
And just to give you guys an idea, Sari works in investments and he advises a lot of real estate investors. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about mindset. So his family, your family came from an immigrant background as well. So you didn't come from a lot of money, just like I didn't. And a lot of people that are probably listening to our podcast. So give people a little bit about what you do and how you help your investors and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. Yeah, I did grow up to an immigrant family. Didn't come from money. We also thankfully weren't, you know, in poverty, but at the same time, we weren't wealthy by any means. And definitely that taught me a lot about money and how to handle money. So I always grew up, you know, very like conscious of money and saving. And kind of that was a big priority to us growing up. And what I do today is I help people kind of meet those goals. So I'm more of like a financial coach. We do like financial planning, budgeting, consulting for clients in all 50 states. A lot of our clients are real estate investors. So for example, if somebody's a real estate investor and they're kind of, they have all these loans, we'll help them lower the interest, refinance, become their own source of financing through the infinite banking system that we help our clients with. And really the reason why like we're doing all this and the reason why I'm specifically doing all this is because of the way I grew up around money. I was always very passionate about it. More of the emotions behind it and how it works. It was just very curious to me. And then especially in the ability, like in business, of being able to duplicate that money and grow it over time. So that way you can actually live the life you want. At a young age, I realized I was like, you know, how is it possible that you're going to spend your whole life in school all the way up to senior year of high school and then go to college. And then after that, you're going to get a job that's going to barely meet, you know, all your expenses. That was just my philosophy. And I was like, there has to be more to it. Like, what if you felt like doing more things in life, like traveling, or building your dream house, or sending your kids to like the best schools? Like, how do you do these things? And it's essentially by making more money. And the more money part isn't about greed, but rather it's about reaching for things. It's about increasing your goals beyond you and actually reaching for those things that you truly want.
It's interesting because like people go to school, they go to college, they get master's degrees, and they have no idea how to manage their money. Yeah. And so they don't really teach money management in school. Like that's something that you start at an early age, in my opinion. I think you should start teaching your kids about money management between 0 to 7. And even in high school, my dad kind of got me a bank account. But when you go to college, unless you take a finance class specifically, even then that doesn't break down how you should manage your daily financial statement. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And even, you know, beyond that, there are attorneys and physicians who literally are in debt. They make like $500,000 a year, but they spend so much money. And they just think that a lot of, especially a lot of highly educated people, the doctors, lawyers, the highly educated people, they're trained that like, you don't need to really know this stuff. Like it's other people are going to do this for you. You can hire an accountant, you can hire a financial advisor, you'll get paid a lot of money just doing what you're doing, and so much money that you won't need to worry about in debt management and growing your money and all that other stuff, you know, which is not true. You know, you still need the understanding of money. I like how you mentioned, you know, at a young age, you know, that's something I plan on doing for, you know, my future kids. Is like, I got actually got the game. I don't know if you know the Rich Dad, Poor Dad game.
Yeah, I have it too. Cash flow. I play with everyone. Play with anybody that I'm cool with. I'm like, hey, come over. Even with I have a son, and I'm like, hey, sit down and play this game. But anyone that's willing to play it and learn from it, I'm like, hey, let's sit down and play it. And I always recommend it on podcasts or on even YouTube videos. I'm like, get this game and get this game. Yeah, man. Love that game.
Yeah, for sure.
You hit on a good point. I think it's a misconception that people have about people that are like lawyers and doctors. People think they have so much money. They can make $700,000 a year, but if they have an $850,000 lifestyle, I mean, then they're broke. But, you know, that's something that is not really talked about that often. It's just people are like glorifying these type of positions because of the prestige behind what it is.
Oh, yeah.
So how long have you been advising investors?
Yeah, so I've been, so overall in the insurance and financial services business, overall about 6 years, specifically with real estate investors in the last 2 years.
Okay. And so with these real estate investors, what do you see the biggest hurdle for them right now? Because I don't know, did you see the FOMC meeting today with Fed Powell?
No, I didn't. No, tell me more.
Basically, they're going to start tapering, you know, $15 billion a month, which is not a lot considering they were doing $120 billion. So tapering $100 billion, I guess that's great. But they're going to keep interest rates low. And we know how that's going to obviously affect the real estate market. So what do you think about that? What do you think about that? And how would you advise your clients considering what is going to happen? They're going to keep rates low.
Yeah.
Inflation is going to keep rising. What would you advise some of your clients?
Yeah, definitely. So we're in super low interest. Obviously, I think that's going to increase the demand in real estate. It's going to keep the demand high, which is good. It's good for the economy when people are buying and selling quickly. And I think that it raises a new topic. And that is the distinction between good debt versus bad debt. And I actually did episode 34 on our show is actually talking about this. Like it's called, should I have a mortgage? You know, should I keep my mortgage? And the idea behind it is, do I just pay off my mortgage? And is that even like a goal that I want to get to? Because interest rates are so low and you could, you know, especially if you're an investor, you're a real estate investor or other type of investor where you have experience dealing in different markets, perfect to leverage, you know, interest rates at like 2.9% from your home. And then keep your home in that situation where you're just constantly refinancing, cash out refinancing, and or using your home as collateral so that way you can leverage these super low interest rates and then use those to invest in other places. Obviously, with the guidance of your accountant and your financial advisor and investment advisor. But I think that that is a good opportunity, the low interest and the fact that you could use your primary home for that with those rates, with those low interest rates for anything you essentially want. So, you know, I think that opens the door for the distinction between good credit and bad credits.
It's funny because people don't, I was talking to my parents and they were like, what's good debt?
Yeah.
And it's like, people don't understand the difference between good debt and bad debt. Bad debt, credit cards, you know what I mean? Things like that. And a mortgage, obviously is good debt. So especially in times right now, like I don't think people understand getting a mortgage is an inflation hedge.
Yes.
So, I mean, if you're locking in $200,000 or $300,000 at 2% or 2.5% today, and inflation is going to keep rising, the cost of assets are going up. Obviously, interest rates are going to turn, and then you won't be able to get 2.5 or 3% in the next, you know, coming year. So, if you can lock in that amount of money, and like you said, do cash out refinances, which are tax free.
Yes,
I mean it's a huge advantage. And Robert Kiyosaki today, I was watching a video where he said he's a billionaire in debt. Right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
he has $1 billion worth of debt, which. Some people might be like, oh man, that's too much debt. Like, who's the guy that's all against debt? Ramsey. Ramsey hates debt.
He wants you to be at zero.
Yeah, I mean.
No debt, and then zero is like the sweet spot to be at.
And it's like, okay, so then you're spending all of your money. So what can you invest in? If you're, say you want to go out and buy a house and you got to spend $300,000 for a house, based on his way, you're going to drop $300,000 cash. But you know what you can do with $300,000, right? If you go out there and leverage, I'm a lender as well.
I mean,
you could put 10% down on a property and put down, let's say it's $100,000. You put down 10 grand at a 3% interest rate and you let it grow with inflation. And so this house is worth maybe $200,000 in 2 or 3 years and you only put down 10 grand. Then you sell it and you take out $100,000 or you cash out, refinance, and you take out $100,000 cash, you know, tax-free. I mean, come on, man. I don't think there's another better way to do that versus dropping $300,000 cash. So you still have $290,000 left to go out there and invest in a stock market or buy another house and keep leveraging the debt.
Yeah, absolutely. And take a step further, you know, check with your accountant. The interest you pay could be tax deductible. So that'll save you money there. And then you could even, you know, the thinking like a bank part, you could borrow, you know, 2.9%, 3% from the bank and then go and do private money lending and loan it out at 12 or 16%, you know, and then keep a spread between there. So there's, you could keep that money moving. And I think that just locking up money within your home is probably not going to be a good idea, because what happens when you want to go take that money out in the future, you know, it can get tricky. I'd rather have the liquidity outside of it and then pay the 30-year mortgage. You know, it's not going to really, I'd rather turn that money over and over again.
How about you break down that concept so people really understand, like be your own bank, like you were saying right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's something called private money lending. And private money lending is just like the title of it. It's people, private people loaning out their money on their own terms and their own conditions. So for example, if I go to the bank right now, and which I'm doing right now, actually, I'm about to close on a house in the next couple of days. We had to go through a mortgage lender, you know, and there are so many federal guidelines. Like, you know, you need 2 years of W-2 income or whatever, bank statements, debt to income ratios have their own formulas. And these are all guidelines by the federal government because of what happened in 2008. So lenders have to do these per law, not just because of their own underwriting guidelines. And then this affects the consumers, the borrowers, because we have to go through all these hurdles. And again, the lenders want to give us their money, but they have to go through these barriers. Now, in private money lending, it's typically for business purposes. So I want to go buy, for example, an investment property. I can go to a private money lender who will loan me the money. And then that person makes their own terms and conditions because it's for business purposes. It's outside of all of the federal guidelines. I'm not going to live in the house. So we don't have to follow the Freddie Mae and, you know, the other federal guidelines for that. Yeah.
Good. And so what's interesting that you say that, because that's what I do. I'm a private lender. Uh-huh. And so the only thing that we require, and it's so interesting that the people that become our clients, they've used traditional banks. And so they see they have to go through the 2 years tax returns.
Yeah.
They got to go through showing 10 months bank statements. They have to go through and showing where they work and do all these different things. And the only thing that we require is 2 months bank statement to show that you have the money to carry the mortgage.
Yes.
And then we require you to have an LLC, which the benefit of having an LLC, like you said earlier, you can write off the interest payments.
Yes.
So if you do a you know, 5 or 10 or 15 year arm, you can write off the entire monthly payment, right?
Yes.
So if you're getting $1,500 a month and your mortgage payment is $1,000 a month, you could write off the whole entire thing, which is the benefit of doing it, like you were saying earlier, under an LLC doing private money.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah. And then you're pretty much buying from one place. You know this, you buy from one place and then you're selling at a higher rate. If I go to the bank right now and I want to borrow $10,000 from them, it's not like they're going to reach in the vault and take out $10,000 and give it to me. They're going to leverage that from somebody else. They're going to buy it at a much less interest rate and then sell it to me for probably 10 times that. They'll buy it at 1 or 2% and then sell it to me at like 10 or 12%, whatever the terms are, you know? So this is where thinking like a bank comes in. This is the name actually of our podcast, Thinking Like a Bank. So this is where the term comes in, is that you're thinking, how do I leverage money? How do I keep moving it in different ways, in creative ways? Private money lending is also good too, because not only can you make that spread, but it's also collateralized. So that means if a property costs, and correct me if I'm wrong, if a property costs $100,000, you would require the borrower to put 20% down, or at least 20% down into the property.
Right. Yep.
And then they pay you now whatever the terms are every month or whenever they sell. But if they don't, then you get the property and the equity. So you can actually make money in the case of somebody defaulting on a loan, because you would take their equity and the home. So in other words, there's still risk involved, but it's a very safe way to increase your income. But you know, there's still risk involved. But I think compared to the stock market, there's a greater hedge against risk.
That's the interesting. I'm always like, you know, I was a banker for 10 years, and I'm like, why do banks do what they do? Because at the end of the day, you can, like you said, leverage the house. If you don't pay, and that's what banks do. Banks typically don't want non-performing assets.
Yes.
So they go through the rigmarole and make sure that this person is a good borrower, right? So they don't want to go through all that and have the underperforming notes. But as a private lender, you're like, please. First of all, we're getting 20%, right? So there's already equity in the house
yes.
from the jump. So then if you do default, we can just come in and step in and just take over the property. And we're already at a surplus because you put 20% down.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I think that's one of the biggest differences too. But I think, I guess on a, as a bank, you know, they just have a larger, I would say, I guess it depends on the lender, has a larger portfolio. So yes, they might not want 35 states with hundreds of people in default. So I guess that's one thing that, the, you know, and plus the regulations, like you said, from 2008, the predatory lending yes, is the main reason why we do have all these regulations now in the financial sector.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Yep.
So then my question is, what do you think people should know as a first-time investor getting into real estate? And what do you know, what, you know, what are your experiences with the people that you've been working with? Are they new? Are they seasoned? Or tell us more about that.
Yeah, so it's a combination of both. And I think that the first step is to make a distinction between active investing and then passive investing. So active is you're going to go out, you're going to find the property, you're going to do the closing, you're going to hire the contractors, talk to tenants, do, you know, all that. You're actually, you're actively involved in the business. Whereas passive investing is where you are simply investing in a deal. You have, you're a limited partner, limited in the sense of liability and limited in the sense of control. You actually can't, usually, typically, you can't control anything. You would just invest into a fund or into a property as a limited partner, and then you would get back monthly or quarterly or annual distributions from that deal, typically 5 or 7 years, and then get your money out. So you're like buying shares of properties or shares of a fund that are invested in real estate. That's passive. So I think the first step is to make that distinction to understand what the two differences are. And then I think that if you want to do get into active real estate, have like a mentor or coach, obviously somebody who's way ahead of you. Something I see most of my clients who I talk to have are part of masterminds or coaching programs. So they have somebody to bounce off ideas off of and somebody who's done what they're doing, like way ahead. Like they're already doing like 200 or 300 properties. So they have something to look out for, like certain things to do certain ways. So that's the kind of like the basics behind it.
I like that. I like that. I think we talked about this a couple of weeks ago too. I think in addition to that, becoming a first-time investor, you have to have the right mindset, yes, right? I mean, mindset is everything because, you know, real estate is a marathon, right? Yes. People think they're going to get in and, you know, the first deal is going to be a home run, and it never, ever happens like that.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So as far as mindset goes, right now, you know, how did you develop the mindset that you have? What do you think about that in regards to when you're talking to your clients? What do you tell them if they are new or seasoned investors? What kind of approach do you take with mindset?
Yeah, so mindset is everything. So 90% of business, investing, real estate, everything you're going to do. So in other words, you could just put real estate investing into the category of business. So in general, in business, 90% of it is mindset. You need to believe in yourself and believe that anything is possible. You need to believe that you get what you think about. So you have to be able to make these projections and predictions in your mind to plant the seeds. So that way you're more likely to get them. This is something I see successful people do is they say like, oh yeah, in the next 5 years, I will have $20 million or whatever. They're planting the road already. They're planting the seeds. And that's actually how they get them. If you don't think that way, then you won't get those results. Now, so that's as far as mindset goes. I think mindset is, you know, 90% of it. And I think that it's, you know, more important than that is you need to think that money is actually not that tangible, where the sense that you can reach for any amount you truly want. You need to take away, like, for example, a lot of people would say, I can't do real estate because I don't have the money. Well, technically, you don't need the money right away. There are certain other ways to do real estate and business with very limited money and using other people's money and that and things like that.
Elaborate more on that.
Yes, definitely. So, you know, like we mentioned, if a property costs $100,000, doesn't mean you need $100,000 in cash to buy it. You probably need a down payment. Now, getting the down payment, this is where you can get creative. You know, you could borrow from somebody else. You could, I don't know, use a credit card. There's things you could do to make it happen. But I think before you get to the technical details of how you come up with the money, how you do this down payment, how you're going to pay it back, before all that, the foundation to all that is your mindset and you believing that it's possible. Because essentially what happens is all of a sudden, you know, through the process of you believing in yourself and taking actions, that's really important. So you believe, you plan, and then you execute. You're actually checking things off your list. It's going from verb to done, like call to called, email to email. Like you're actually completing tasks. Once you get to that point, all of a sudden you find yourself, you know, in the middle of a real estate deal. You know, you manifested it. It happened almost in autopilot now because your mind took control, your subconscious took control, which is more powerful than your conscious.
It's funny because I talk about the reticular activator all the time. And a lot of people don't know what that is, but it's like your brain's filter. Yeah. You know, your brain filters maybe like 120 million bips per second, right? Your brain would explode if you didn't have this particular activator. So what it does is it acts as a filter. So whatever you program this filter to do or think about, that's what you bring about. So it goes back to what you're saying. That's why visualization is a huge thing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, just think about it. When you want to buy a car, you always see this car everywhere. That car has always been there, but you just program your brain like, I want to buy this BMW. So now you see this same BMW 1,000 times a day. And you saw that BMW 1,000 times a day before, but your brain did not filter for that specific thing. So once you program this particular activator, your brain is going to subconsciously do exactly what you're telling it to do. And that's why you say you end up doing the deal in your mind. You think you can do it. A year later, you're in that specific deal or you're doing deals subconsciously because that's kind of how it works.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. So you need to be cautious about what goes in your brain, like put only good things in there and then, you know, fill it up, you know, so that way your mind is filtering the right things. And then ultimately it takes like autopilot. It picks up on its own things. You start making decisions that revolve around the things that you truly want, the things that you truly think about and desire.
So then how did you program your brain to think the way it did? Because obviously, like I said before, like we talked about before, neither one of us came from those backgrounds and both of us are doing the same exact thing. So what did you do?
Yeah. So one thing I did was I read a ton of books. Probably since over the last 7 years, I probably read maybe 300 books.
Oh, wow.
About psychology, sales, marketing, business, entrepreneurship, success, self-help. Kind of that. That's actually the only things I read. I don't read really any fictional books or literature or anything like that. I just read only books that I think could improve my business. So that was one huge thing. And then the other thing too is I became like obsessed with podcasts and YouTube videos. I love, you know, learning these things. These things have kind of become part of my language because they sink into your subconscious, the way you speak and everything. So that's something I've been, you know, doing is learning from a lot of people. I also have, I've hired like 5 coaches in my past and I have a current mentor right now. So that's also a huge impact too. Somebody that you can bounce ideas around, somebody who could give you guidance and maybe even give you the wheel for you to come up with your own systems. So this is where coaching comes in handy. So it's like, you know, a consultant would just say like, do X, Y, and Z. Whereas a coach would ask you, what do you think is the best move? Or what system do you think you can come up with that would help you the most? And then now, as you're talking, well, I'll do this. You know, I'll write off a checklist. And then I'll use that checklist and I'll add it in my calendar. And then I'll go to my calendar and I'll set a reminder. You're creating your own methods and your own systems, which is more important than somebody just telling you what to do. So this is where you take control. And then now what happens is, even after that coach is, you're no longer with that coach, you keep those same systems and those methods in loop mode. They're constantly running and they're constantly going. So then you could take those same systems. And then no matter what you do, whether you're a mortgage lender or an insurance agent or a real estate investor, you're going to apply those same things over and over again, because it's like a language that you can just kind of duplicate.
It's funny that you said there's 2 things I'm going to bring up. You said it tells you what to think. Yes. That's my thing with institutions. Like when you go to college, it doesn't tell you how to think.
Of course.
It tells you what to think. So then you get out into the universe, in the world, and you're pre-programmed already. So you're just doing basically what your boss tells you to do.
Yes.
You're just basically what anyone tells you to do. You're doing that because you don't actually know how to critically think, which is a huge issue. And that's kind of what you need to be in an environment where you're a real estate investor. And then another thing you said was Miles Monroe. Miles Monroe said, we don't decide our future. Our habits decide our future.
Yes.
So like you just said now, all the things that you said, tell me a little bit more about your habits that you have. Listening to the podcast, what do you do in the car when you're commuting? Tell us about your habits.
Yes, definitely. So I'm always listening to podcasts. And I have this app. I forgot what it's called. It's called 12 Minutes. And it's like every book on there. Almost a lot of books are on there, just condensed into 12 minutes, like summarized. So I'll either have that. But sometimes I do like to turn off my brain and just listen to music and just stop like working and stop thinking. But yeah, if it's a long commute, I love listening to podcasts. But I like to also listen to like a podcast, audiobook, and read the same book of the same person or the same subject. So that way I can get different spins on it. And when you read something, you probably only retain like 10% of it, something like that, something Correct. Small, like 10%. Yeah. So when you're learning about it differently in a different way, like through audiobook or watching that person talk about their book on YouTube, you're going to learn different angles of it.
Yeah, because what you said scientifically, they do 2 different things. One is for the subconscious and one is for the conscious.
Yeah.
So that's why like listening to audios and reading the book makes a huge difference, because your brain is going to retain it 2 different ways.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that's a good point. In addition to that, you know, breaking down the habits, you also have to have a desire to do what it is we're talking about. And obviously, if you listen to this podcast, you do have a desire for that. What made you want to get into finance? I know you talked about, you know, the way you came up, but you still have to have a passion to want to dive this deep into getting into finance. So what kind of drove that?
Yeah, it was the passion of money. It was it was how money works. And then it was also solving problems. Like I always wanted to, for example, this might be a silly example, but do you remember, have you ever seen the movie, The Shawshank Redemption? Do you remember the part where that one guard, the mean guy, was talking about how he inherited money from his uncle? And then the Andy was the main character, right?
Yep.
Andy was listening and then he gave the guy advice. I thought that was really clever, like how people actually know these things, like about taxes, about mortgages, about interest rates, about money. And people who tend to know about these things tend to get ahead in life because they understand how the system works, you know, how the country works, how laws work and things like that. So that's really what I wanted to learn. I wanted to learn how to take those principles and concepts and strategies and like translate them to other people. I got my MBA, got my insurance licenses, went through financial planning training, went through the Bank on Yourself organization training. And I still, you know, still reading books, still watching YouTube videos, podcasts, still learning a lot more. I still have a long way to go. My next step is to do the CFP program, okay. Certified Financial Planner program. I'm going to start that next week. So there's, you know, so many things to do. And it's really a passion of money and how money works in society that really got me hooked.
I agree with that. Kind of the same thing. I mean, at least for me, when you come from nothing, the only way you can go is up. And so that's kind of like how I got into it. And I think I just had a desire to want to help a lot of people, and which is one of the reasons why I created the app. With that, I mean, you mentioned insurance.
Yeah.
Some of the listeners might want to know, what are some good insurance tricks? Because I know that you can take a whole life policy.
Yes.
And so give us some tricks to the trades with using insurance to buy properties, if you know any.
Yeah, definitely. So one method is the infinite banking system, which is when you use whole life insurance, you use the cash value in your whole life insurance policy. You could borrow against that cash value, and then you could use that cash value as for down payments, for renovation costs, or for the actual properties if you have enough cash value. So what that means is there's typically three types of life insurance. There's term life, whole life, and universal life. Term life is like a set period of time. It's like 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. There's a start date and an end date. So for example, somebody's 40 years old. They want to do a 10-year term policy for $1 million, and they're going to pay $50 a month. So that means for 10 years, they pay $50 a month. If something happens to that person passes away, their beneficiary, usually their spouse or kids, would get $1 million in this example. If they survive, the insurance company keeps the premium and they it's like renting. You don't get anything back from it. You can extend those terms afterwards and go through underwriting all over again and pay more. There's whole life. Whole life is for your whole life. There is no end date. There's a start date, but not necessarily an end date. And there's also cash value. So every time you're paying for the insurance, two things are happening. One is you have life insurance. And the second thing is you have cash value. You have like a savings account within the policy. And that savings account portion earns interest and dividends from the insurance company, like a savings account, but typically 40 times what a savings account would pay in today's market. So this whole life policy is earning dividends and interest. If it's structured the right way, it's going to grow significant cash that you can leverage. And the universal, in essence, is a combination of term and whole life. There is cash value. It could be for a certain period of time. But for to keep it basic, we'll talk about whole life insurance, cash value, building that up. And if you and it has to be, so there's about 1,200 life insurance companies in the United States. And the strategies we talk about only work with 3 out of 1,200 life insurance companies. And
can you give us those three?
Yeah. So it's Security Mutual, Foresters Financial, and Lafayette Insurance Company. And the reason why it's only these 3 out of 1,200 is because they have to provide certain riders, something called the paid up additions rider. It also has to be a mutual insurance company. So here's a checklist. So number one, it has to be whole life. Number two, it has to be mutually owned and not stock owned. Mutual life insurance companies give dividends back to policy owners, whereas stock owned insurance companies give their dividends back to shareholders. The third is you need the paid up additions rider. The paid up additions rider helps you increase cash significantly over time. And the fourth thing is it has to be something called non-direct recognition. Non-direct recognition means that if, for example, I have a life insurance policy, I have $50,000 in there, I borrow $10,000 from it, in a non-direct recognition company, the money will grow whether I have an outstanding loan against it or not. So whether I borrow or not, the cash value in the policy will grow. And this is key to being able to grow your money and using it at the same time. The opposite of non-direct recognition is direct recognition, whereas if I borrow, then the insurance company will recognize that loan and then maybe reduce interest or dividends if the credit based off of the loan being outstanding. So you want to make sure it's non-direct recognition. Think about it this way. If you had a house that was $500,000 and then you let's say you paid it up, there has no mortgage on it, and then you borrowed $100,000 from a bank through a line of credit leveraging your property as collateral. When you borrow that $100,000 from the bank, does your house value change at all?
Does not.
It doesn't. It keeps appreciating even with that outstanding loan against it. Same is true with life insurance if it's non-direct recognition. The market value of the policy is not impacted by outstanding loans.
One thing I was asked a couple of weeks ago, and that's why I came to you with this question. Does the death benefit decrease on that loan amount that they take out? So say, for instance, it's $500,000 and take out $100,000. Do they now get $400,000 at death? Or how would that work?
If the loan is still outstanding and the insured passes away, then the insurance company would take the overall death benefit, subtract the loan that's due with interest, and then pay that out to the beneficiary. So, but if they pay off the loan before the person passes away, which is what mostly happens most of the time, then the insurance company pays the full death benefit, which keeps climbing every single year. Also, sometimes, like how you mentioned, Robert Kiyosaki has like $1 billion in debt. Sometimes, especially wealthy clients, they'll have numerous policies, especially when they're in their retirement years, like age 60, 70, 80 years old. They'll just borrow like $50,000 or $60,000 at a time from their life insurance policies. They don't need to pay them back because they have significant death benefits and they're in the millions of dollars. So when they do pass away, when that time comes, they'll take millions of dollars, you know, subtract, you know, $100,000, $200,000 from it, and the family's still going to get millions of dollars from that. So in other words, the comparison of the cash value loans to the death benefits climbing every year, it's really not comparable. It's going to be a huge delta between those.
So there is no limit to how many policies a person can have, right?
Technically, the amount of policies, no, there are no limits to how many. Now, there are limits to the aggregate total of life insurance coverage you have. So for example, typically there's brackets. If somebody's like 35 years old, they can typically have 25 times their annual income. So they make $100,000 a year. They can get $2.5 million in life insurance coverage from one company or from 100 companies. It doesn't matter. Right. As long as the sum of all those companies equals 25 times the annual income, that's one metric. The other metric is their net worth. So for example, if somebody has $1 million in the stock market, they could get $1 million in life insurance as long as they could prove how they're going to pay those premiums over time. And then sometimes it's a combination of net worth and income combined together. So this is how we can get clients approved for more than they could actually get approved for. And then that's one area. And then the other thing is too, is that some insurance companies, like for example, Lafayette Insurance Company, you can have a spouse, like let's say there's a husband and wife and the wife doesn't work, but the husband does, and the husband can get a maximum of $2.5 million. Then what could happen is the wife can also get life insurance without having to prove any income up to $1 million and then half of that at that point. So $2.5 million. So she already have $1 million plus half of $1.5 million. That's $750,000. So husband can get $2.5 million. The wife can get $1.75 million, all with the same income that the husband had. And then you could even add on the kids too, if you wanted to, or grandparents. So you can keep insuring other people in your family or in your business with you being the owner to open up more insurable limits.
That's right. Because I did the same thing. I worked at Northwestern Mutual for a while. And I remember now what you're saying is all you have to do is keep adding beneficiaries and you can increase the amount. Yes. That is correct. I know people are probably wondering, how do they know how many policies you have? In the underwriting process, I'm pretty sure it all pops up when, say, for instance, Lafayette wants to underwrite and they're like, does it come up in the system? How many policies you have or how does that work?
Yeah. So insurance companies share data. They share claims. They share data to protect each other. So this way, for example, if I have $1 million of Security Mutual and I want to go to Lafayette, they have some sort of third-party services that shares that data. Similar to what banks do. If you, for example, banks share data too. Like if for example, you were with Chase Private Client and then you go to Bank of America, they probably can't see how much money you have in Chase's bank account. And correct me if I'm wrong, you're in the banking industry, but they could see that you are one of the top clients. Like they have like, somebody explained it to me, there's the dollar signs, like $3 signs is like a really top client and $2 signs and $1 sign. So they could evaluate that data and figure out what kind of clients you are. And same with insurance companies. They share these data. Like for example, Allstate, if you get into a car accident and then you try going to Farmers and Farmers ask you, have you been in a car accident in the last 5 years? Allstate is going to tell Farmers and then all the other insurance companies that you were in a claim. So this way, Farmers will charge you more or deny you coverage based on the claim that you had outstanding. So they share this data to protect each other and to also protect consumers.
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, we use a system called FIS. And as soon as you put in the person's information, it brought up almost everything. OFAC, information, it brought up almost like everything you're saying. So that makes sense. And I knew that too. Just wanted, I know people are having those questions because it's like when you buy a property and then you want to insure that property, they're like, this house had flood damage. This house had a new roof. Like they instantly know before you, you know, get the policy, before they underwrite it, it comes up.
Yeah. And to add on to that is, imagine if you you bought a property and then you insured it with Allstate, Farmers, State Farm, Geico, you know, every insurance company out there, and then the house burns down. It's like all those insurance companies are all going to pay you all the market value of the house. Yeah. You know, they have to share this data just to make sure people don't do that.
Insurance fraud, man. Insurance fraud. again, that's what happened with AIG in 2008. Yeah. Exactly what you're saying. I think all these huge firms had bought all these different policies, and exactly what happened. People were doing crazy stuff. Interesting, man. That's good. And it's funny because I literally just had this conversation a month ago with someone, because I have a friend who uses his policies and he buys apartment complexes in San Antonio doing exactly what you said, using the insurance. Then you just have to, what's the trick to that? What's the trick to accumulating these high cash balances? Basically just paying more upfront when you initially get the insurance, or you just pay more into the premium every month?
So it depends on the situation. It depends on the client, how they make money, how much they make money and how frequent they make it. It depends on that. So there are actual ways to fund whole life insurance policies with your current dollars that you currently have. If you're a business owner, let's say you're a business owner and you have certain expenses that could wait like next year. Like for example, if you own your property and you have property taxes, you can opt in to pay them once a year in some situations. If you have sales taxes, you can pay them quarterly. You can, there are certain expenses you have that are not due in the moment, so you can reroute them into a life insurance policy. And then when that time comes, you take out a policy loan to pay those expenses. What this means, what this translates into, is that you don't need extra money to put into life insurance. You could use the same dollars that you're already using. So you already make money. You're already spending money. If you could put it through a life insurance policy first, if you have the time, typically 2 or 3 months to pay expenses, you could put it through a life insurance policy and borrow against that and pay, and then keep a system going where you're borrowing, paying into a life insurance policy, paying back the loans, borrowing, and you keep doing this over and over again, like a system. And we help clients with the system. Then you could essentially use other people's money to fund your life insurance policies.
And this is also tax-free because you're taking out a loan, correct?
So the growth is tax-free in most situations. The loans are tax-free. The withdrawals are tax-free. And the death benefit is tax-free. And you could borrow from the policy to use in your business and then write off. Look, for example, if I bought some office equipment, I could borrow from the life insurance policy, use those borrowed money tax-free to buy the office equipment, write off the cost of the office equipment through that. And then maybe even another layer too is check with your accountant. But I could, in some situations, even when I borrow to pay for the office equipment, write that off and then write off the interest I use. If it's for business purposes, if it's properly documented and you have the go-to from, you have the green light from your CPA or tax attorney, you could potentially write off the interest you paid to use that money. So you have a spinning wheel of tax advantages in many different ways.
And this is not money laundering, I might add.
No. To take it a step further even, to make it you know, even better, Andre, the cash value in the life insurance policy in most situations is protected from creditors and judgments and government agencies and things like that. So in other words, you could this is what rich people do. They have, you know, billions of dollars in cash value life insurance. It's, they have the family as beneficiaries and access to it. And then, it gets to the point where you look like you're poor on paper. If somebody were to see, like Robert Kiyosaki, if you were to sue Robert Kiyosaki, it would show up he has $1 billion in debt. You know, a lawyer wouldn't even want to take on that case because it's not worth it. He has no assets on paper, which is what you want. That's how you want your financial situation to be. You want to, you want to look almost poor on paper, but have as much cash as you want in a life insurance policy. It's not public information. And it's an exempt asset in most states, like in the state of Illinois, in the state of Florida, it's an exempt asset. If somebody sues you, they can't leverage that money. They can't use that money against you or take that money from you. Again, check with your attorney. I'm not an attorney, so there might be certain things that I'm missing, but it's a very powerful asset protection tool. So I can, essentially put money as much as I can into life insurance, be able to borrow anytime, get all the tax advantages of doing so, and protect it for other people. So I can get rich without having to worry about getting sued.
It's funny. We don't want to say anything to incriminate ourselves on this podcast.
Yeah.
So I've mentioned this before too on a podcast. I don't think people understand that's how the wealthy transfer wealth through life insurance. Yes. You know what I mean? And so, like, I don't know how many of my friends in general, like when I was growing up, or my parents or anyone who had a life insurance policy, right? So it's like the easiest thing to do, especially if you just get a term life. It's like 50 bucks a month.
Yes.
And then if you died, you could do a million. I think I have $2 million or something like that. One policy that I pay like $51 a month. If I die, my son would get like $1 million or whoever the beneficiary. So that, I think that's one of the advantages of doing life insurance in general. But a lot of people don't want to do it because who wants to pay car insurance? We got to do it just in case something happens. But I don't know. I mean, you just gave a very good reason on why people, if you don't like doing a term, you should definitely want to do a whole life policy because it's not a waste of money. And that's what I think people think about when it comes to insurance.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there are certain, if you talk to a competent advisor, somebody who knows cash value life insurance very well, not just an ordinary life insurance agent, but somebody who really knows how cash value life insurance works, there are ways where you can use the same dollars you're already using to fund the policy. In other words, you're just repositioning, rerouting the same dollars you have to build something much greater for the future.
So then what would be the biggest difference? I understand universal life as well.
Yeah.
What would be the biggest difference between universal and whole? Just to give people the...
So typically whole life insurance, the way it's underwritten, like for example, somebody's 40 years old male in the state, whatever state they're in, the rate they get, there's a cost of insurance for that. It's going to be different than somebody who's 80 years old. So the cost of maintaining that policy tends to be the highest in the first couple of years, but goes down throughout the years and does not change. It doesn't get rewritten or changed throughout the life of that policy. Universal, on the other hand, tends to increase in value over time. So the cost might, in the beginning, might be a little bit less, but the cost, so every year, what's happening is the universal life policy has an annual term, like part to it, where every year it's renewing the term policy. So age 40, age 41, age 42, and it gets to the point where the policy becomes very expensive to maintain in the later years because it keeps renewing. So the amount of insurance you're paying for at the age of 40 versus age 60 is going to increase, and that's going to eat into your cash value and the growth of it in the later years. Whereas whole life, you don't have that. Whole life, you see a constant growth, even on the guarantee. So you have two sides. You have guaranteed side and the non-guaranteed side. Both of them, you have consistent growth on whole life policy. I one time was with a client and we were going through his universal. He had a current universal life policy. And then there were three sections. There was guaranteed, non-guaranteed, and then like extra non-guaranteed, where it was like much higher rates. And on the guaranteed side, for cash value at age 65, which was 35 years of paying into the policy, the guaranteed was zero. The non-guaranteed was like $1 million. And then the super non, whatever the extra non-guaranteed was like $3.5 million. So what the insurance company is saying is, we'll guarantee you nothing. Like there's a chance that you can get nothing out of this policy, zero cash value from all the years of paying into it. The middle is where you probably have $1 million in cash value based off of the markets, based off of how the insurance company did, based off of their fees. And then the extra is, you know, $3 million. And then the agent was selling it between extra $3 million or $1 million. You got to be in that range. You won't be in the zero range. However, think about it this way. That's a risk you're going to take. Like, you know, I would never want to sign my name on that contract that says that there's a chance I might end up with $0 at age 65 in the policy that I've been paying into for 35 years.
Yeah, very true, very true. Interesting. So then when you're dealing with most of your clients, are they buying real estate through whole life policies, or they're just, how are you structuring your deals for your clients you're working with right now?
Yeah. So it's a money thing. So sometimes the entire cash value is being used for property. So they'll find a property, it comes time to close, they will borrow from their life insurance policy, become their own source of financing, essentially their own mortgage. That's one way. Another way is they're still using bank financing because, again, bank financing is good for mortgages. That's a good source of capital. They would use their life insurance policy to pay the down payment, which, by the way, banks allow you to do that. You can borrow against the policy. The bank asks you, where did you get this 20% down payment from? You can say, I borrowed from my life insurance company, from the life insurance policy that I have. So that's another way, down payment. Or the third way is, if there's just beginning, they could use it for renovations, for closing costs, for the inspection fees, for things like that, the smaller fees, they can use a life insurance policy for that, pay it back, and then over time, essentially, get to the bigger thing. So smaller expenses, down payments, and then becoming their own mortgage if they wanted to.
It's funny because listening to you, you have the SEP IRA that a lot of business people have.
Yeah.
And then you have this, yes. Right? The SEP you can only do, I think, $15,000 a year. You know that better than me.
Yeah, there's limits. Yeah, I know it's self-directed IRAs and
correct.
Regular traditional IRAs. It's like $6,500 a year or $5,500 a year, something like that. It's very minimal. There's contribution limits to them. Also, more importantly than the contribution limits, there's limitations on what you could use the money for. So, for example, if I have a self-directed IRA, I can't tap into that money, take it out, and then go buy a property that I own. It has to go through a third party, separate entity. It can't be my spouse, my kids, or my parents. It has to be a completely separate entity. I can't, you know, everything has to be like external to you. You can't mix, you can't have any control over the property either. It has to be a property manager that has to take care of things. So there's a lot of restrictions with self-directed IRAs. With life insurance, no restrictions at all. I could borrow from the money and then go to the casino if I wanted to. I could borrow from the policy and then, you know, invest in the stock market. I can literally do anything I want with that money.
Do they have a minimum requirement for the cash, you know, the cash value before you can do a loan? So say, for instance, you like, hey, I'm about to buy this house. Instead of you dumping $6,000 into a self-directed, why not drop $6,000 into a whole life insurance? Can you go out and then take out a loan of, I don't know, $3,000? Or does it have to be like $50,000 minimum before you can start taking money out of the whole life?
So typically, you at any point, you could borrow up to 90% of your cash value. So this means, wow, that month one. So look, I'll give you an example. My first policy that I started, I have three policies now. My first policy that I started, I put $300 a month in. And then in the first couple of years, there's not going to be much growth, but still, there was a little bit. So I put $300 in month one. My cash value month one was like $150. I was able month one to borrow up to 90% of $150 right away. So month one, I can make that transaction, turn around and take out a loan. So at any point, the rule is you can take out, with the companies that we mentioned, the three companies we mentioned, you can take out up to 90% of the cash value at any given time.
So in your portfolio right now of insurance providers you use, are you using these three, or are you kind of tapping into 10 or 12, or who are your main go-tos when it comes to this?
Yeah, so I use all three. I use Forces Financial, Security Mutual, and Lafayette. I think more common, I use Lafayette Insurance Company just because they have a little bit of extra benefits. Like, for example, they have an online portal that has, you could make payments, borrow, you could do, it's almost like online banking. You could do through the company, through the portal. So that's my favorite one to use, Lafayette.
So do you have like a minimum for your clients that you deal with? Do you like, hey, don't come to me unless you have $250,000? You know how some people are like, you only want to deal with accredited investors because you don't want these people calling you every day like, where's my 10 grand? You know what I mean?
Yeah, so I don't have a set criteria. I'm looking for more mindset. I'm looking for, if you have a mindset that you want to achieve big things in life, you want to take that next big leap, you want to do things unconventionally, that's who I want to work with. I want to work with you. If you have that mentality where it's like, I want to do things differently, I want to think differently, I want to think like a multi-billion dollar company, I want to think like a billionaire, that's who I want to work with. I'm not the kind of advisor who says, you know, you need to show me that you have, you know, $500,000 in the bank just to get me on a phone call. It could be really be any amount. It's more of mindset. And with bank on yourself, it's never like the end product. It's never like, we're going to meet, you and I, Andre, we're going to do a policy at $1,000 a month, and that's it. That's the final product. It's like, it's going to be a coaching program for life. We're going to do this, you know, we're going to fund a policy. And then after that, I'm going to, you know, we're going to sell properties and then put the money back in and do new policies. So it's going to be a recurring of every 6 months, we're going to have a 1 hour call. We're going to look at the cash value in your policies. We're going to look at your income, your real estate portfolio, what's happening, what needs to be pivoted, and constantly do new policies, you know, policies for your kids, policies for business partners, policies for employees to retain them. You know, you're doing all these different things. So that's actually the most important part of this process. You want to work with somebody who you see yourself working with on a repetitive, consistent basis, not just somebody who's going to just sell your product one time and that's it, you're set for life. I don't think that way. I think it's an ongoing process.
It's funny because that's how most insurance people are. Like I said, I worked at Northwestern Mutual, and it's like, get that policy and run, right? Because you can make, you know, a couple $1,000s on one policy, and they're like, man, I just took that money and ran. But your approach is obviously a lot better because you get ancillary sales from one individual. So it makes sense to build that relationship long term. Yeah, I mean, especially because you're dealing with people that are investors, maybe in the early stages. And if you're getting, you know, in touch with them in their 30s, they're going to keep doing this. I don't know no investor that got in at 30 and got out at 30, you know, two, right? They're in it from, you're like 30 to 65 or 70, like you're in it for the long haul. So then my other question to you is, do you have any limitations on where you can write? Can you write all 50? How does that work?
Yeah, I can write all 50 states. All my work is done over Zoom and over the phone. So yeah, there's no limitations on where you are. We could maybe even do outside of the country. If you come to the US frequently, like for example, if you live half the year in like Mexico and then half the year in the US, that would also work. But yeah, there are really no state limits. I can do any, if I'm not licensed in a state, I can just get that license, typically in the insurance world, getting licensed in a state is just you would log into a website, pay the state fine or the state fee, and then like 2 business days later, you would get your insurance license.
So when it comes to, because I know a lot of people are going to want to know these and they're going to reach out to you, man. I'm sure I'm calling you myself. So when it comes to the policies, when you want to add cash to it, say I want to go out and buy a house in a month and I'm going to have to put down a 30% down payment. Can I come to you in, I don't know, 2 days from now, get a policy, drop $30,000 into it, and then a month from now, take out the $20,000 that I might need for the down payment?
Good question. So yes and no. There are certain policies you could do that. If it's a single premium policy, you could probably put $30,000 in and then a couple weeks later, take out $20,000. But for the most part, if it's a policy that's like $10,000 a year or $20,000 or $30,000 a year, if you put $30,000 a year, I don't know any of your specific details, but let's just say, for example, if you put $30,000 in, your cash value year one might be $20,000 and you could borrow up to 90% of that. So maybe like $18,000, maybe $17,000, $18,000 you could take out. And then you could, even though you're buying the policy annually, you could month one do $30,000 and then borrow from the cash value that's on an annual basis.
So let's dive into that a little bit further, because I know that's going to come up. When it comes to, like, for instance, a term life insurance,
yes,
it's $50 a month and you're guaranteed, let's say $700,000.
Yes.
But based on what you just said right now, if you put $30,000 down, that's going to be your cash value. But what's going to be your policy if you were to die? Would it be that $30,000 you put down?
Or definitely. Yeah, so that's the premium. So if you put $30,000 in as premium dollars, your cash value year one. So for example, year one, your premiums are $30,000. Your cash value might be $20,000 year one. And then your death benefit might be, depending on the age, I would say around $800,000 if it's $30,000 a year. So yeah, if you put $30,000 in year one and you pass away, your beneficiary would get $800,000.
Okay, there we go. That's kind of what I wanted to outline, because I don't want people thinking if I put down $30,000, that's what my death benefit is, because it's exactly not that.
Yeah. There's still a major life insurance component to it, which is still important. But obviously, we're doing this for money while we're alive, to turn money over and over again.
I like it, man. I like it. I mean, if those of you guys listening, this is what you should be doing. I mean, he just broke down all of the reasons why you should do something like this instead of a self-directed. And a lot of people talk about self-directed and things like that, but you're so limited in what you can do with that. And you might have some mentors, like even my real estate mentor, you know, he's like, yeah, why don't you just, you know, buy this in a self-directed, but you got these stipulations that you can't do. And I like this, the fact that you can, you know, add as much as you want and take out a loan whenever you want to, because with a self-directed, if you do take out money, I think you are going to be penalized for that, even if it's a loan, right? I believe so.
So it depends. So if you're the self-directed IRA, if it's, you're allocating it properly towards real estate, correct. You wouldn't pay loan, you wouldn't pay taxes, but there has to be the limitations on there on what's happening. Correct. If it's a regular IRA, a traditional IRA, and then you take money out before the age of 59 and a half, you could be hit with a 10% tax penalty along with the ordinary income tax that you would pay on that money coming out. So, and the same with the 401k, very similar rules. So there's limitations. Either you're pretty much locked up until age 59 and a half with these qualified accounts.
And there's really no benefit. It's not like you're going to get 20% interest on any of these, right?
So yeah, 401ks are expensive to maintain. So that's another thing too. So, for example, if you have a 401k, you're building it up. You have $300,000 in a 401k. It's not like that's it. Like that's the growth of the, you still have tax. You still have taxes that you're going to owe on all of that, plus fees every year. Typically 1 to 2%. Typically they're higher on 401ks, and you pay them every year whether the account goes up or down. So really, I don't think it's that significant, the growth. I think it's realistically like 5%. Even though some people might say it's 12% or 10%, the market at 10%, the market at 12%. I think realistically, it's probably going to be 5% after taxes and fees.
And you got to think about it. If you're doing real estate and you're doing investing, you're going to be in a higher tax bracket at that point in time. So keep that in mind. You could be out here with $10 million in the bank, and when it's time for that IRA to cash out at, you know, 59 and a half, you're going to be in a way higher tax bracket. So I think what he's saying with the whole life just makes way more sense for anybody trying to get into real estate or just basically, you know, protecting your money long term.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good point. So when you have a life insurance policy, you essentially are in a 0% tax bracket. You're converting when you're funding the policy, you're paying money on that, you're paying taxes on that money going into the policy and then converting now into a 0% tax bracket. So over the years, as a real estate investor, as you're making money, as you're making profits and sales, you can put them into the life insurance policy. And then essentially when you retire, when you're done working, or you just have your passive income now, you're inside of a 0% tax bracket in the life, as far as the life insurance policies go. So you kind of created a shield from taxes, from creditors, from market risks, and from banks too, because you can borrow your money whenever you want. You don't have to go through the bank's rules anymore. You can go to your own policy and borrow it anytime as long as you have cash value in the policy.
Man, Sarah, you just gave us all gold. You did. Like, this is like a hidden gem. A lot of people, I worked in banking, I worked at No Sweat Three Mutuals, because I know about these things, but the average person doesn't know about what you just talked about. So you just broke down a hidden gem that everyone should be doing. And you don't even hear about it. You don't even hear about people on YouTube really talking about this. So, I mean, you just gave us something that everyone should be trying to take advantage of if you're listening to this podcast from, you know, now in the future for real estate investing, or even, you know, with securities, you know, whatever it may be. Yeah. So then I wanted to ask you this. I know you mentioned that you are an avid book reader. 300 books is a lot, man. So what are two books that you recommend to our listeners?
So Becoming Your Own Banker by Nelson Nash is one of them, which talks about the infinite banking system. And then a second book, Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. It's a really good book, yeah.
Yeah, like I think that book was, for me, is the one that did it for me. It just, because it breaks down. I think the one thing that stuck out to me was like, you're selfish if you don't go out here and try to make a bunch of money, right? Because you're basically benefiting yourself and you're not benefiting society in any way. So the more money you have, the more people you can help. And I think him saying be obsessed with making money for the benefit of others is what like struck me like, what? And you're going to make money in turn doing that, right?
So absolutely. Definitely. Absolutely.
Man, I appreciate your time. That was gems. I know I'm going to try to get as many people to you as possible. I already know a guy that I have in mind, I'm going to send his podcast to, and then give him your information because he wants to do exactly what you just said. So I'll hook him up with you. Tell everybody how they can reach you or get in touch with you on social media, or how they can get in touch with you for your products.
Yeah. So the best way to reach me for everything is through one website. It's finassetprotection.com, finassetprotection.com. You can connect with me there. You can connect on LinkedIn, YouTube, the podcast. You can go to my calendar link and schedule an appointment, a free call with me. You can download a book. Everything is on that one website, finassetprotection.com, finassetprotection.com.
And again, thank you again, man. This has been great, very informative. I just learned something that I will be doing myself again. It's funny because you find all these tricks in the trade, but once you get going into the industry, when you start working, you just forget about so many different things because real estate is so like, it's so fluid. You always have something going on. So you never have time to really think about certain things. So man, you just helped me out with a lot, but thank you again, man. We'll definitely bring you on again in a couple months. Thank you guys for listening. And we'll see you on the next episode.
Thanks, Andre.
Aren't you ready to start a business or grow your real estate investing portfolio? If you answered yes, allow Andre and the expert advisors at the Residual Roads Business Institute to fast track and put you on a path to full-time investing. The greatest transfer of wealth in our lifetime is occurring over the next few years, and you can take advantage if you know what to look for. In order to be successful at real estate investing, you need to learn how to leverage your current resources to generate quick money, big money, and retirement money. Let Residual Roads advisors craft a plan to get you through these phases using little or no money in 6 months or less. Don't wait for a job. Create one for yourself and others. Go to residualroads.com for mentorship, and for our free course, go to residualroads.thinkific.com.